and smiled. "I take it that's why you're here, to buy in."
"Yes, master. I'm here to join the cartel. The opportunity to make a lot of money. My ship is at the cartel's disposal."
"Glad to hear it," Hakunin said, leaning forward to feed one of the songbugs some seeds through the delicate bars of its cage. "Well, let's get the business over with. Then I'll treat you to dinner at La Voce's. It's a ritual the cartel has. First, though, a simple matter."
"You mean the buy-in price?" said Siskind.
"Indeed I do. 750,000 crowns. A bond will do, or a bank testament."
"I don't have it."
"A bond?"
"No. I mean I don't have 750,000 to give you."
Hakunin frowned. "Then this meeting is over, Master Siskind. Thekla made you aware of the details, didn't he?"
"When did you last see Thekla?" Siskind repeated.
"This meeting is over," Hakunin spat. "Go away, and stop bothering me with your—"
"Thekla's dead."
Hakunin dropped the last of the grains onto the table and brushed his hands. He looked round at Siskind. "What?"
"I can't be sure," said Siskind, "but I believe my cousin is dead and the October country lost. At Bonner's Reach, you sent him to trap and destroy an Imperial Inquisitor, Gideon Ravener. Am I right?"
"Go on, sir."
"Ravener had got too close. He was sniffing around the Contract 13 cartel, pretty much onto you. So you lured him into Lucky Space to dispose of him, out where no one would care or notice."
"I won't confirm or deny," Hakunin said. "But I think you've said enough. I thought you had come to see me to buy into the cartel."
"I have," said Siskind. "I don't have the cash, but I have something just as valuable. A place in the cartel. That's my asking price."
Hakunin thought for a moment. "Very well, but it had better be good. If you're trying to play me, Siskind, I'll have you thrown from an air gate into hard vacuum."
"Thekla always said you were a mean bastard to deal with."
Siskind got up and gestured towards the door. Lucius Vorner walked in, his armor grating as he moved. He was carrying a bundle in one hand. "This is your price?" asked Hakunin. "This bounty hunter scum?"
"No,"
Vorner boomed. He dropped the bundle onto the floor.
"This is the price."
The bundle stirred and uncoiled. Bloody, bruised and torn, Sholto Unworth slowly raised his head and looked at Hakunin.
"I know this wretch." "Unworth," Hakunin said.
"Indeed," said Siskind. "Sholto, tell the nice man what you told me. What was the name of the passenger you brought from Bonner's Reach and delivered here to Eustace Majoris about a week ago?"
Unworth mumbled something.
"Speak up,"
Vorner growled, kicking him.
"In all appraisal," whispered Sholto Unworth, "his name was Ravener."
Part 2. Interior Cases. Chapter 1. A tide of trudging people, millions strong, flowed into the inner formals of Petropolis. From the air, they created a steady rushing river delta in the surface-level streets, a web of tributaries and streams feeding main estuaries. The tide sobbed out from rail terminals and transit stops, or welled up from lower sink levels like dark water from secret underground springs. In the open streets, the tide moved under a skin of nodding gamps and parasols. In the covered walkways, it ran like ink. Few people spoke. There was no clamor of voices, just the tramp of feet, the hollow booming of tannoy announcements, the cries of gampers and food vendors touting for business. Pale-faced, this was a multitude starved of sunlight and drained of expression. Dark eyes, tinted goggles, suits and robes of emerald, black or grey, the regulation colours of the clerical workforce. Ocular augmetics here and there, skin plugs and neuro-link spinal ports, mechanical braces perched like brass spiders on hands deformed and crooked by carpal tunnel syndrome. Ear jacks for transcribers and stenographers, vox grafts in the mouths or throats of dictators and transcriptors, wheezing quadrupedal walking frames, their stilt legs folded for the archivists and filing officers who worked amid the towering shelves of the index vaults. Almost 400,000 allergies to paper, dust, ink, or all three. Nearly 2,000 undiagnosed malignancies to face, brain or throat, from excessive exposure to screen radiation. All of them moving in the same direction, into the vast towers of the administry. And I was watching just three of them. The carriages jolted to a halt, and the automated doors rattled open, disgorging another cohort of administry workers to swell the tramping tide. As soon as it was empty, the rail transit would close its doors and clatter off into the airless ducts of the sink levels to pick up workers of the administry night shift, who were currently leaking out of the tower's basement exits in equal numbers to the day workers flowing in on the surface. The various departments of the administry never slept. The cogitators ran all day and all night, chattering and processing. There was Patience, in the midst of the crowd, moving with the flow. I saw her glance at her own reflection in the windows of the carriage, and felt her distaste. Her hair pinned up, no makeup except for some shadowing around the eyes to give her a hollow, sleep-deprived look, a unisex suit of cheap black linen and an emerald jacket. Just another scribe, another clerk, another administry drone. The swollen crowd pushed out along a dank, rock-crete concourse, past black iron railings and down a wide flight of stone steps, out of the transit station. The lips of the stone steps had been smoothed and worn down by decades of footsteps, so they looked soft and indented like unplumped pillows. Through the station arch, under the copper eagle suspended from the glass roof, into the street, into the main flowing bustle. Patience was nudged several times by the press. If I stop walking, she thought, the pressure of bodies will lift me off my feet and carry me along like driftwood. The street was covered by an ironwork rain shield, but she could smell the raw acid wetness in the air outside. Overhead, tannoy horns were crackling out inspirational mottos. There was an unappetizing odor of cooked onions and fatty meat coming from the barrow ovens of the curbside vendors. The massive ooze-like tower of Administry Hall 3 rose up ahead like a ziggurat, dim and hazy in the morning smog. Patience eventually reached the mouth of the entrance hall, a yawning maw 10 meters high, like the door of an ancient tomb. The graven visage of the God Emperor glared down at the workers from the overmantel. No one looked up, but every worker raised his or her hands to make the sign of the Aquila as they passed beneath. Inside the stone hallway, the massed footsteps echoed like rain. The flow of workers began to subdivide into the warren of side corridors and passages, heading for their appointed stations and departments. More instructions rang from the ceiling speakers. Patients saw PDF guards watching over various junctions, weapons slung, but they were not checking papers. Wall-mounted optic scanners at each doorway or hall mouth read every worker permit that passed through, marking each one with a flashbulb flicker and a tonal ping, logging them into the system. Patience saw the brief flash as her own permit was read. She began following the indicator signs for D:G/F1. The tide began to thin out. The hallways had once been carpeted, but the pile had been eroded back to frayed matting, like the bed of a dry stream. The air smelled of dry dust and static, and the photovoltaic lamps cast everything in a tobacco-colored stain. She passed by the doorways of large cogitation chambers, glimpsed the endless rows of clerks at stations, heard the seamless clattering sound of 10,000 fingers striking keys. In the hallway, quill servitors scuttled past. Copy boys ran through, carrying dispatch boxes. Gaggles of scribes hurried to meetings with transliterators and cipherists. Gatherers pushed their heavily laden basket trolleys. Tech adepts shuffled along, hefting tool crates, heading for the latest repair. The walls were lined with the twisting, branching tubes of the pneumatic dispatch system. Every few seconds, there was a burp of air as another message cylinder rushed past inside one of the tubes. Patients arrived at the entrance to Department G/F1. The optic scanner flash-pinged her again as she entered, and a hololithic sign lit up with the words, "Wait here." She waited. Beyond the doorway, she could see the huge chamber, high-ceilinged, gloomy, lit by the enormous hololithic display screen at the far end, swirling with green data forms, and by the rows of individual desk lights on the scribe stations. There were at least a dozen rows, an aisle between each, and Patience counted something in the order of 100 stations in each. There was a cacophony of rattling keys. Copy boys and gatherers moved up and down the aisles, delivering and collecting files. Servo skulls drifted down the aisles like bees hunting pollen.
Thrawn, I'll go mad in a place like this.
The beating heart of the Imperium, I sent back. But for the ceaseless work of the Administratum, civilization as we know it would grind to a halt.
What? Are you recruiting for them now?
She looked round, back out into the hallway. In the wall directly opposite the department entrance was a shrine alcove where the blessed seniors of the Administratum performed the hourly rites to bless and favor the work of the scribes.
That's odd, don't you think?
She said. The alcove was dusty, as if it hadn't been used in a while. There was no water in the placatory dish, and the sheaves of herbs were limp and desiccated. I agree.
Junior scribe Merit Yevins?
Patience turned. An elderly female, an ordinate, approached. She was robed and hunched, her claw hands blue with ink stain that would never wash out.
Yes, ordinate.
The woman held out a blue hand and took Patience's permit slate.
You are transferring from Division 6, rubrication?
Yes, ordinate.
You have manual skill in excess of 80 norm?
Yes, ordinate.
Junior scribe Merit Yevins had died in a road traffic accident 3 days before. Carl had scooped her records from the Informium and grafted them to provide Kiss with a genuine administry background.
Follow me.
The ordinate led Patience down one of the aisles. Pale-faced scribes hunched at their cogitators, gazing at their glowing yellow screens, their hands fluttering over the metal keyboards or turning the pages of the documents clamped in their articulated reading stands. Patience had to watch her step to avoid tripping on the cables and trunking that spilled out across the floor. The ordnance seemed to know where they all were without looking. The old woman gestured to an empty cogitator station.
Begin here,
she said. She waved a gatherer over, rifled through the alphabetized files in his cart, and took out a bulging sheaf of crumbling documents. She handed them to Kiss.
Transcription, she said. Destination database is K8456 decimal. What is the destination database?
K8456 decimal, ordinate,
Patience replied.
Begin.
The ordinate limped away. Patience sat down at the station and woke the cogitator. It mumbled and shuddered as it warmed up, the valve screen slowly glowing into resolution. It scrolled data noise for a moment, then opened to display an entry gate and invited her to type in her serial code and destination database. She did so. The screen trembled again, and the optical display closed like a flower, then reopened to reveal a new file, ready for transcription. By then, Patience had arranged the sheaf of papers on her reading stand, open at sheet one. She secured it around the corners with some of the old rubber bands dangling off the lip of the frame. Carl had briefed them well on basic clerical habits. She even slipped on the plastic thimble that aided page turning.
Here we go,
she said. She started typing. It was copying by rote. The figures in the document had no meaning she could discern. After a few minutes, she reached her left hand into the pocket of her coat. The little analyzer Carl had given her was there. With her fingers, she played out its tiny plug wire, and with the analyzer still out of sight in her pocket, brought the wire end up onto the station and plugged it into one of the spare data ports on her cogitator.
Getting that?
Carl's getting a signal now, thank you. He says you're operating a late-model K-fiber cogitation engine with numerical reinforcement subframes.
The stuff he knows.
Kiss sent back, and carried on typing.
I thought you'd done this before, said Gatherer Lerily, with a sneer.
Like all the Gatherers, he was a big man, with heavily muscled arms and shoulders well displayed by his black singlet.
I have, said Nail, but it was a different system in collect-distribute where I worked. We had to number the files in a docket before we put them in the cart. Well, that just wastes time, Lerily sighed. He pointed to the data slate in Nail's hand. Your numbers come up there, file and destination, and you wait for the matching serials to flick up on the boards. Then you gather from the bench, swipe each file past your cart scanner, and it's all logged. See? Simple. I don't know how they did things at your old place, Tulliver. Nail shrugged. He had no idea how they'd done things at Berno Tulliver's old place either. Berno Tulliver had been stabbed to death in an undersink mugging the month before, and, courtesy of Carl, Nail was just borrowing his credentials. Right now, he was standing in the bowels of Administry Hall 3. It was hot, furnace hot,
thanks to the steam from the hydraulic hoists. Queues of brawny gatherers, each one with a cart, were assembled in front of the benches, watching the overhead hololiths. As numbers flickered up, gatherers moved forward to the benches to collect their cargoes from the robed coordinators. Behind the benches, the enormous cage lifts brought up file cartons from the basement archives in clouds of vapor.
"I'll walk you through one," Lelily said.
He was a gatherer supervisor and wore the medal proudly.
"Thanks," said Nail.
More numbers flashed up on the overhead boards.
"That's you,"
Lerily said. Nail pushed his cart forward. It had a twisted caster, and it fought to go the other way. Nail winced as the strain pulled at his damaged arm.
"What's the matter with your arm?"
Lerily asked.
"Nothing. Fricking wonky wheel."
"Get used to it,"
Lerily said unhelpfully.
"Once you've been here a while, you'll get a better cart. Perks of seniority."
"How long is a while?"
Lerily shrugged.
10, maybe 12 years.
Hurry up! You never keep the coordinators waiting."
Nail slewed his cart up to the bench and showed the coordinator his slate. The robed man turned and hefted a bulging carton of papers from the cage lifts.
"Now, swipe them off," Lerily said.
Nail took each file out of the carton and waved them in turn past the optical reader built into his cart. The dial kept blinking up, unknown.
"Frick's sake, Tulliver,"
Lerily exclaimed. He licked his thumb and rubbed the wet end vigorously across the glass lens of the reader.
"Dust builds up. It's the static. Try it again."
Nail swiped the files again, and the dial snapped up code numbers. Once his cart was full, Nail slid the empty carton back to the coordinator, who slung it back onto the cage lift.
"Okay," said Lerily. "Now you deliver. Check off the codes against your slate and use the department map. You'll soon find your way around."
Nail nodded and swung his heavy cart towards the elevator bank. He glanced at his slate. P/S4. That was on the 57th floor. The way his cart was bucking and pulling wide, he'd never even reached the lifts.
"Holy throne," he whispered.
"Stick with it, Harlan."
"Easy for you to say, boss. I'd rather be doing something less demanding."
"Like what?"
"I don't know. Killing someone you don't like."
"Are you sure you're up to this?"
"Will you leave it alone? I'm fine. I want to do this. I want to be doing something. Belknap said I was fit, didn't he?"
"Yes, though I got the distinct impression he wasn't telling me something." Kara Swole stiffened.
"Like what?"
"I don't know. I didn't probe his mind. I respect doctor-patient confidentiality. I just got the impression he'd given you a clean bill of health because you'd told him to."
"Gideon, I don't intend to sit this one out, all right? This is a serious deal, and you need all the help you can get. So I'm helping. I'd rather be doing this than sitting in that lumpy bed in Miseramus."
"Is it really that lumpy?"
"Oh, yes."
"And your wound? It's stable? It's only been a few days since you tore it open chasing Sko."
"It's fine. Now go away. I'm trying to blend here."
"Wienerkavort, what are you doing?"
Kara looked up at her supervisor, a dainty little man with augmetic eyes. His name was Beedron Halicut. Ordinate Ordinary Beedron Halicut.
"I'm loading the tubes," she replied.
In truth, her answer should have been,
"I'm perched on an uncomfortable metal stool, nursing an aching belly wound and the grim intimations of my own mortality, jamming numbered message cylinders into the spout ends of pneumatic tubes in the sweaty basements of Administry Hall 3, all the while pretending to be someone who perished from tubercolic fever in an ecclesiarchy hospice 10 days ago."
"But that, naturally, would lose her the job."
"You might think you're loading the tubes,"
said Ordinate Ordinary Halicut,
"but I believe you are inserting the cylinders upside down."
"Oh,"
Kara said. She looked at the Plastex cylinder in her hand and slowly upturned it.
"Sorry."
"I thought you were skilled,"
Halicut said sharply.
"Just confused, sir,"
Kara replied.
"By the new system. On Caxton we loaded them plug-end first."
"Well, Kavort, you're not on Caxton now."
Halicut moved away to berate another tube loader. The pneumatic tube dispatch hall was a massive room in the sink levels of the tower. Like stalactites, festoons of tube pipes fed down into the room, curving slightly to deliver the cylinders into rows of wire racks. They looked like inverted church organs. Schools of operators sat at the ends of the racks, sorting the cylinders that arrived with a burp of air loading new ones into the ascender pipes. Newly arrived cylinders were opened, and their contents filed into cartons for the gatherers to wheel away. Fresh files came in to be wound into scrolls, cylindered, and sent on their upward journeys. The air pressure in the chamber kept popping and changing as the tubes barked and spat their loads. Kara glanced at the stack of papers she had just been given by a gatherer. It was just meaningless data, reams of figures. She wound it up tight, slid it into a tube, and pressure-fired it on its way. In Miseramus' house, I relaxed for a moment. Nearby, Frauke was playing regicide with Zale. He'd finally got the boy to understand the rudiments of the game. Zeph was prowling the grounds, checking the sensors. Karl was at his station, watching the first links show up from Kara, Kiss, and Nail.
"I'm getting a decent feed from patients now," he reported. "I just..."
"What?" I asked. Karl frowned.
"I can't figure out what they've got her doing. The data she's processing makes no sense. Just random series of characters and numerals without context. Maybe it's a cipher. Give me a while and I'll see if I can crack it."
"I have complete faith in you, Karl," I said. We were in now, really inside the heart of the mystery. I remember thinking that, feeling the satisfaction of it. How wrong I was. Shipmaster Akunin had taken a late luncheon at a private club in the high stacks of Formal Sea, then travelled back to the Petropolitan in a hired limousine. He was edgy, and his mood did not improve when he reached his suite.
"Anything?" he asked his aide.
"Still no response, sir,"
the man replied. Akunin cursed quietly.
"If there's nothing by this evening, I'll send another message."
The aide nodded.
"Master Siskind is here to see you."
Pulling off his blue satin coat, Akunin went into the lounge. Siskind was sitting in one of the low armchairs.
"Siskind?"
Akunin said by way of hello. He crossed directly to the sideboard and poured himself an Amasek.
"Still nothing from Trice. Can you believe that? My messages are as emphatic as possible, and he deigns to ignore me. Drink?"
Siskind shook his head. Akunin sipped his drink, pacing. The neotropical songbugs, sensing his demeanor, had fallen silent.
"The arrogance of the man," Akunin spat. "Without the cartel's work, he'd be nothing."
Siskind nodded gently.
"Another hour or two, and I'll send to him again," Akunin growled. "I've half a mind to go to him in person, see how he likes that."
Akunin's personal hand vox chimed, and he took it out of his pocket.
"One moment,"
he said to Siskind, and raised the device to his ear.
"Akunin?"
"Just calling to see if our employer has answered yet," said a voice.
"Who is this?"
Akunin asked.
"It's Siskind. I was just..."
Akunin lowered the communicator and turned to stare at the man sitting opposite him. Siskind got to his feet. He seemed to ripple, to shimmer, as if the image of Bartol Siskind was just a reflection in a disturbed pool. Then the ripple stilled itself again, and Akunin was staring at a mirror image of himself.
"Oh, Terra!"
Akunin gasped and started to run, dropping his glass and his hand vox. His double caught up with him before he'd taken three steps and seized him. Arms pinned, Akunin crashed forward against the sideboard.
"Please, please!"
he squealed. The grip constricting him grew tighter.
"Sire Trice is happy not,"
the double lisped, sliding a long, slim, serrated blade out of its cuff.
"Oh, no, please!"
"Let him go, Monica,"
said a voice from the doorway. Akunin stepped back and let the real Akunin slump to his knees. Taurus Revoke padded into the room, his stale yellow eyes showing amusement.
"Get up, Akunin," he said.
Trembling, Akunin did as he was told. In all his dealings with the secretists on behalf of the cartel, Akunin had never found Revoke anything less than terrifying.
"You seem to have taken it upon yourself to become a nuisance," Revoke said. "What's the matter with you, shipmaster? All these pleading demands for a meeting?"
Akunin eyed the secretist warily.
"I think what I've got to say is important."
"So? I'm here now. Say it."
"Not to you. I need to speak with Trice. A personal meeting,"
Akunin began. Revoke raised a finger to his lips.
"First of all, it's Chief Provost Trice.
Second, the remit of Contract 13 states clearly that you of the cartel and the Chief Provost should not be seen together. nor have direct dealings, nor any connection be apparent between such parties. Third, something tried to kill the chief provost the other day. We've been a little busy since then, trying to discover what it was and who sent it. In comparison, you and your pathetic mewlings are a very, very low priority.
I know. Please, I know that. This...
I could have you killed, Revoke said bluntly. I could have Monica here do it. She's very good. Akunin glanced nervously at his double, but it wasn't his double any more. It was hardly anything. A woman, vaguely, a hazy blur in the air that light seemed to ignore.
What is she?
Akunin asked. Monica? She's a dissembler. They're very rare. It's a form of albinism, an extreme mutation form. A dissembler's pigmentation is so shockingly absent, they act as living mirrors, reflecting back likenesses. It's very useful. Monica observed your friend Siskin when he visited you earlier today, and mirrored him. Oh, Master Akunin, the look on your face.
You've been observing me?
Of course we have, Revoke replied. The fuss you're making, this unseemly frenzy to meet with the chief provost, it's just not on, Akunin. Not on at all. The provost is furious with you.
Of that I have no doubt, Akunin said, recovering his composure a little. He runs a subsector. I run a ship. I am small fry. I understand that. Me, the other shipmasters under contract, we are just pawns in his great theatre. We do the grunt work, get paid, well paid, am under no illusions. We are supposed to get on with our job and be invisible.
Well, you seem to appreciate it quite clearly, said Revoke. It begs the question. Akunin looked Revoke in the face.
I have been insisting on a meeting because I know something that may well be directly connected to the attempt on the chief provost's life. We have a mutual problem. The entire venture is in jeopardy.
Really? Why?
Gideon Ravener is still alive, and I have reason to believe he is here on Eustace Majoris.
Taurus Revoke stared at Akunin for a long moment.
Do you have proof?
Yes.
Bring it with you.
Now.
Chapter 2. It was the third time she'd called that morning. The switchboard put her through, but all she got was an autovox invitation to record a message. For the third time, she didn't. The town hab was quiet, just the ticking of the numerous crons and horologs her uncle had collected over the years. Maud Plighton paced around the gloomy house, agitated and anxious. She froze when she heard the music. A sudden four-finger chord, then a rill, and a sprightly refrain. It was coming from the drawing room. Uncle Valerin was seated at the spinet, playing one of Steremann's bagatelles from memory. Plighton stood in the doorway and watched him, her eyes welling up. Every few weeks her uncle would do this. Like the sun passing out from behind a cloud, his lucidity would briefly return, and he'd play. Then the clouds would return. The patches of lucidity were becoming more infrequent these days. Valerin stopped playing.
"Enid," he called.
Enid was the private nurse, and she wasn't due in until 3.
"No, it's me, Uncle Valley," Plighton said, entering the room. "Don't stop playing."
Valerin tinkled a few more notes and stopped again. He reached out and took his niece's hand, squeezing it.
"Maud, I thought you were Enid," he said.
"No, it's me," Plighton said, knowing her uncle would drift away at any moment.
"How are things with you?"
he asked.
"Problems," she said.
"What sort?"
Valerin replied.
"Magistratum matters, no doubt."
She smiled sadly.
"Yes, Uncle Valley.
Department troubles. You don't want to hear about them."
"Don't I?"
he said, and let go of her hand. He played a series of plangent chords.
"It's out of tune," he said. "There, up D. Little flat."
He struck the note repeatedly.
"I don't play this very much now, do I?"
"Not as much as you used to," she said.
Valerin looked up at her. His face was in shadow.
"I know, Maud," he said.
"Valley?"
"I know. Moments like this, I know how I am. Fading. Not always there. There are blanks. These long intermissions. I don't remember. It's very frustrating. I know you're a magistratum officer. I know you've been living here with me for some time, but I've no idea how old you are, or what happened yesterday. I know I have a nurse, Enid, right? So, if I have a nurse, I must be ill.
Uncle.
It's very frustrating. Very frustrating.
He fell silent.
Then he started and looked up at her again. What was I just saying, Enid?
Maud, Uncle Valley. It's Maud.
Yes. Silly old me. Maud. My, how you've grown. How are things with you? Have you got a job, my dear? Man on the go?
Plighton sighed.
Uncle Valley, I've got to go out for a while. Enid will be here in another hour or so. Will you be all right?
Enid? The nurse?
Oh, her. Yes. Yes. I'll be all right.
Plighton walked back towards the door, wiping her eyes on her sleeve. The spinet behind her rang out suddenly. A Kronika Valse. Uncle Valley?
I remember, he said, without looking round. So much, and so little. It's very hard. The only thing I know for sure is that when the moments of clarity come, use them. Like now. I don't know if I'll ever play again, so I'd better play now. Use the moment. Seize the moment. You never know how dark it's going to get otherwise.
Good advice, Uncle Valley, she said.
I thought so, he said. Do what you can, while you still can. Otherwise, she looked back. The music had paused.
Uncle?
The upper D, there. Little flat, wouldn't you say?
He tapped at it.
Little flat, isn't it, Enid? Little flat?
Yes, Uncle Valerin, Plighton said.
She could hear him striking the note over and over as she left the hab and headed for the rail transit.
Oh, it's you,
said Limwall, opening the door.
Yes, hello,
Plighton said.
Nice gown there. Are you going to let me in? What are you doing here?
Limwall said, gathering his shabby housecoat around him self-consciously. I rode the transit all the way to E to see you. Can I come in?
Limwall hesitated, then reluctantly let her inside his cramped little hab. His face showed the ugly bruises that the fists of the interior case's marshals had left on it 2 days before. He looked scared.
What do you want?
He asked, attempting to tidy up the clutter in his bedsit.
Just thought I'd hang out with a work colleague,
Plighton said.
You've never hung out with me.
No, I haven't. Sorry, that was a lie. I wanted to talk to someone.
About what? He replied.
She stared at him with, what the hell do you think, eyes.
Limwall shrugged.
I think you should go, Plighton. I don't think we're meant to be speaking to each other. Rickens told us to go back to our habs and wait there to be questioned.
Have you been questioned, Limwall?
He shook his head.
No, but the interior case's investigation will...
Plighton scowled.
Screw that. Screw them. It shouldn't work this way.
She paused.
I tried to contact Rickens.
Limwall blinked at her, his eyes wide.
You did? Yes, at the department.
I don't have a private contact for him.
He's unavailable.
Plighton looked back at him.
Since when was Rickens unavailable to his own staff?
Since we all got suspended, Limwall suggested, archly.
But you've got a link. Here. You told me.
Limwall sighed.
That was a secret.
I know. And they seem to be very popular in the city right now.
You told me you'd enhanced your personal cogitator with department codes to keep up with the workload.
Limwall, I think we need to use it. We need to know what's going on.
I think we should leave it the hell alone, he said. That's what I think. I think if we start meddling, we'll end up in trouble.
Look what they did to your face, Limwall. We're already there.
Start with Rickens. Blanket search.
Crouched in front of the battered second-hand cogitator set up in the corner of his hab, Limwall thumped the keys.
Service record. Yeah, nothing else. Says he's on extended leave and directs all inquiries to interior cases. All right, scrub that.
The Allsman case. Call it up.
Blyton read out the case file number. There's no such case listed. Nothing, Blyton. Not even as closed or restricted. Seriously, nothing.
Blyton folded her arms and stared at the floor. I opened the case file myself the day Olsman's body was found. All my scene of crime notes, the pics I took. They've removed it all and erased the traces.
Magistratum files don't just get erased, he scoffed.
Yes, they do, she replied. I've seen it before.
That's nonsense, he replied, shaking his head. Who has that kind of power?
Blyton didn't answer. All right, try the names Weigott and Kuber. Marshals, interior cases.
Limwall chattered the keys and then shook his head.
Nothing. No listing on personnel.
Were they the two goons who got in your face at the old sacristy?
Yes. Now search for Yearnwood, the limner who witnessed Olsman's death.
Limwall tapped at his keys.
Nothing. Nothing in magistratum. Nothing in civic records either.
Was it a false ident?
No. He checked out at the time. Run it through the Informium data core.
I did. There's nothing.
Holy throne. They're hiding everything.
Limwall turned to look at her. Who's they, Blyton?
Someone with real power. We're into subjects of a legitimate investigation, Limwall. Even interior cases isn't as brazen as this. Last time I saw Rickens, he told me the Olsman case was the key. We'd mishandled it somehow, and it was all connected to that assassination attempt on the Chief Provost. Well, I don't think we mishandled it at all. I think we found something there in the sacristy. We just didn't realize what it was.
This false ceiling you told me about.
Maybe.
She started buttoning her coat and headed for the door.
I'm going home. You pulled me that file on the old city plans. I'll go and start working through it, see if I can't find something we've missed. You stay here and stay in contact.
Remind me, why are we doing this? She grinned.
Because we serve at the pleasure of the God Emperor, and because someone I love very much told me to seize the moment, because you never know how dark it's going to get.
The sky was turning to a dull undercast as night closed in. Blyton hurried along the pavement as the burn alarms started to sing and the first spatters of rain started to fall. Too far to run in this. She ducked into the doorway arch of a townhab to wait out the downpour, just 100 meters from her uncle's house. The rain began to stream down. From the cover of the sinks, the Gamper boys started to yell their trade. She waited. Her mind was ticking over, like one of her uncle's horror logs. Just a year before, in Rickon's office, the blanked case.
No good will come of it, Rickens had told her.
There was a sudden beating of wings. She looked up. A flock of sheen birds swirled up into the rain, turning like a shoal of fish, twisting east. Something made her very uneasy suddenly. A sixth sense. What Rickens liked to call the magistratum muscle. Ignoring the rain, Blyton ducked out of the archway and ran along the street to the hatchway of the parking garage. She knew her uncle's code and punched it in. The hatch opened. The attendant, the old man with the apron, waved at her as she walked inside. He knew her. She was the girl who came in to use the Bergman. The attendant wandered away. He was busy soaping up the bodywork of a crimson transporter owned by some local bigwig. Blyton slipped through the rock-crete gloom, hugging the shadows. Rainwater was gnawing in between the garage's joints, pooling on the floor in pungent pools. There was the Bergman, Bay A9. Blyton didn't have the keys. She peered in through the driver's door window. There was the folder Limwall had given her, still tucked into the door pocket. She'd come back for that, once she'd got the keys from Uncle Valley. She walked round behind the automobile and felt around the dank back wall of the bay for the loose bricks. She kept an eye on the old attendant. He was still washing the crimson transporter. Blyton lifted 3 of the soot-black bricks out. The Transvasa 9 was where she'd hidden it, in the cavity, wrapped in visicloth. She had no permit for the weapon, but every magistrate and marshal owned a backup piece. It went with the job, service weapon and a concealed. You never knew when. Blyton took it out, heavy, chromed, rubberized grip. 10 in the clip, 1 in the spout. She eased the slide half back, saw the glint of the chambered round, and slipped it back. Beside the weapon,
two more fat clips. Plighton put the clips in her pocket, slid the 9 into the waistband of her trousers, and put the bricks back. She waved at the attendant as she walked out of the garage. The front door of Uncle Valerin's townhab was ajar. Plighton pushed it wide. She could see immediately that something had happened here. Something ghastly. It was as if an erosive force had spilled through the hallway, shredding the wall panels, abrading the carpet, demolishing all the furniture. Plighton took the transvasor out. The door to the front parlour was half open. Plighton saw a scattered mess of red bare bones, loosely gathered in a torn blue dress. The shredded remains of a nurse's starched white headdress. Plighton swallowed hard. Uncle Valley. Uncle Valley. Weapon braced, she edged along the hall. The place looked as if it had been sandblasted. The wallpaper was stripped, the floorboards scrubbed to bare, splintered wood. The oil paintings on the walls were just empty frames adorned by rags of canvas. Plighton paused at the doorway of the drawing room and peered in. Something bony and raw lay on the worn-down carpet in front of the spinet. The spinet itself looked furry. Its once polished surface was chewed and splintered, the varnished wood pocked with a maelstrom of tiny chips. The curtains were in tatters. Uncle Valerin's notation folios were shredded. A large, slender man was hunched over Uncle Valley's reduced corpse. Broad-shouldered, with a mane of wispy grey hair, he wore a suit of leatherjack with an armoured sleeve. Drax turned as he heard a sound behind him. His curiously wide face, with its small piggy eyes and a massive underbiting jaw, blinked in surprise. He rose and started to pull out the cyber lure. Plighton fired. Her first shot took off the left side of Drax's face. The second went through his chest and blew out his back. Drax slammed backwards into the ruined spinet, the half-slung lure wrapping around his body. His weight toppled the keyboard instrument over beneath him, onto the floor, with a discordant clash of strings and keys. Her eyes burning, Maud Plighton took one last look at her uncle. She backed out of the room. In the litter of debris in the hall, she found fragments of the jar that had always stood on the shelf above the heater. Nearby, she found the Bergman's keys. On the pavement outside, running now, she snatched out her handvox. "Limwall! Limwall! It's Maud! Get out! Get out now!" Chapter 3. The weapon servitor reared automatically as Revoke approached. It cycled up its gun pods and played its pink recog beam up and down his face. Its handler yanked at its leash and brought it to heel.
"Sorry, sir," the handler said.
"Don't be," Revoke replied. "I admire vigilance. I was told he was here."
"Yes, sir. He's inside. Please observe the drill."
"Of course." Revoke stepped past the handler and his chrome-plated cannon hound and went over to the rack of bare metal drawers screwed to the stone wall. He slid out an empty drawer and placed inside it his weapon, his handvox, his wallet, his cron, and every other single item about his person that was either powered or bore writing, numerals or inscriptions of any sort. Then he closed the drawer and took down one of the blunting charms that hung from the row of hooks above the rack. As Revoke put it around his neck, he felt the pendant weight of the heavy lodestone against his chest. More particularly, he felt his precious sigh stutter away into temporary exile. Then he stepped into the air gate. All of the entrances to the Encompass Room were actual starship air gates, imported as brand-new units from the yards at Ur Haven in the Antimar sub. It seemed odd to pace down the cold stone hallways of the Lord Governor's Palace in formal A, and then step into a vacuum lock of brushed steel and recessed lumen panels. The outer hatch closed. Revoke felt the prickly gust of the decontamination blowers and heard the vents suck the soot and dust away. Then the inner hatch opened. To step from ancient fortress into an air gate was one thing. To step from an air gate into this was quite another. Taurus Revoke had been in the Encompass Room more than a dozen times before, but it still impressed him. Circular, over 500 meters in diameter, it had been constructed from the uppermost 4 stories of palace. Revoke was actually stepping out onto a steel bridge walkway that extended out across the chamber, 2 floors up in the air. The walkway met 3 others like it, that sprouted from hatchways at the other compass points, to form a platform above the centre of the room. Above, the roof space was black, and out of the blackness, powerful stab lamps hung down on chains, like stars in the night sky. Below, the floor of the chamber was a brilliant white expanse like the surface of a sunward moon. This entire floor was patterned with a delicate tracery of black lines and other details, all of them too fine and small to be seen clearly from the bridge. But Revoke knew what the intricate pattern represented. He peered down and saw the small figures of the many geometricians on their knees, adding details to the pattern with their consecrated quills. Only a few small portions of the overall pattern still lacked any detail. Revoke could see the chief provost standing up on the viewing platform. He hesitated when he realized that Trice was not alone. The Diadochoi was with him. Trice saw Revoke and nodded for him to join them. Revoke approached with unease. The Diadochoi was spending an increasing amount of time in the Encompass Room of late, eagerly anticipating the culmination of the work. The Diadochoi was tall and slender, dressed in simple black clothes. His head was bare, and, in the Encompass Room, he chose not to wear his public face. Revoke tried not to look at the Diadochoi's true visage. The contorted pink flesh, the features fused and melted down like candle wax after a long night.
"Revoke," the Diadochoi gurgled liplessly. "Come to me, my son."
Revoke obeyed. The Diadochoi embraced him and kissed both his cheeks with the wet wound he called a mouth. Revoke could smell Nidos and unguent creams.
"Yeda tells me you saved him the other night,"
the Diadochoi lisped. "He did, Lord," Trice said.
"Against a beast from hell, I hear,"
the Diadochoi said, the heat-blackened stumps of his teeth showing against the pink as he smiled.
"Any clue yet as to what it was?"
"We are following some leads," Revoke replied. "Leave that all to us, Lord," Trice cut in. "Do not trouble yourself with nothings. You must concentrate your mind on the true work." The Diadochoi nodded. He took Revoke by the arm and led him to the platform's rail.
"Isn't it beautiful? Quite, quite beautiful. We have made adjustments just this last morning. Recalibrations according to the refined axes. You see there, where the geometricians are erasing."
Revoke looked and raised his hand to point. "You mean?" The Diadochoi's black-gloved hand caught hold of Revoke's and squeezed it shut with nearly bone-crushing force.
"Don't point, Revoke. Not in here. Any gesture can be a signifier. You should know better."
"I'm sorry, Lord." The Diadochoi let his hand go.
"Where the geometricians are erasing, that is the angle of adjustment. Fate gives, even as it seems to take away. Don't you think?"
"Yes, Lord."
"By morning, the new axial points will be inscribed. It's all very promising. Now, what did you want?"
"I need a word with the chief provost," Revoke said.
"A word?"
The Diadochoi made a wet, gurgling sound that approximated to a chuckle.
"A word in here. A word. You're a witty man, Revoke."
"Am I, Lord?" The Diadochoi turned to Trice.
"See to your business, Yeda. I'll be here when you return."
Trice took Revoke by the arm and walked him away along the bridge to the air gate. Behind them, the Diadochoi was still peering down from the platform at the working scribes below. The airgate hatch closed, and the air scrubbers whirred. "He seems in a good humor," Revoke said.
"He is. We're very close now, Taurus. The chance discovery at the old sacristy the other day. It's the piece we've been missing. Now we've got it.
Everything is falling into perfect alignment, all our calculations and projections.
The true center.
Just that. At last. It was no wonder that we couldn't make things match up. No wonder, indeed, that everything we'd tried before didn't work.
So, said Revoke,
we're close.
Just a few days.
Trice looked at him.
He scares you, doesn't he?
A little bit, Revoke admitted. Yeda Trice smiled as the other airgate hatch opened before them.
Be thankful. He scares me an awful lot more than that.
So why have you come looking for me?
They were retrieving their possessions from the rack of drawers. As soon as he took off his blunting charm, Revoke realized the guard nearby could hear them.
Not here. Let's walk.
Ravenor. Empty gods, are you sure?
Revoke nodded. The shipmaster's evidence is quite compelling. Trice sat down on one of the private suite's sofas and wrung his hands as he thought.
Get me a drink. Amasek. Molomot. Anything.
Revoke went over to the cabinet and found a glass and a bottle of 80-year-old nepenthe.
If Ravenor is here and active, it could explain the killing of the cartel's banker.
Chaikov.
Yes, and it could also explain the attack on you at the palace.
You've still turned up nothing on that.
Revoke handed his master the glass.
We know it was some form of incunabula, some slaved proto-demon. A killing tool directed by a psyker. I've had the Psy Adept arm of the secretist searching covertly since the attack, but in a hive this size, without wanting to show our hand.
Would Ravenor use a demon?
I mean, really?
Revoke shrugged. We've studied his records through the Officio Inquisitoris Planetia. He's known to be hard line, but his master was Eisenhorn. And you know what's said about him.
Even so, said Trice, sipping his drink.
You told me you'd killed the psyker operating that thing.
I did, most surely. His name was Saul Keener, a local black market psyker with prior form. Ravenor wouldn't have been so impetuous as to slave the thing himself. He'd employ someone. He relies on his agents. Still, right at the end there, I sensed another mind. Ravenor himself, no doubt, looking in to see if the job had been done.
Damn him! Trice spat.
The Diadochoi mustn't be told. He'll go mad.
Of course.
Yeda Trice put his glass down and rose to his feet. He was agitated. When that demon thing attacked us, I suspected this faction, this cult, that coven. All these years, so many accumulated enemies. The one thing I didn't even begin to consider was Ravenor. He's meant to be dead.
Akunin has proof otherwise, sir.
You've brought him here?
Revoke nodded. Under the circumstances, I thought I should.
He got up and waved a control wand at the end wall of the suite. The entire wall became transparent, so they could see out into the adjoining anteroom, where Akunin waited nervously with his companions.
That's Akunin there?
Yes, sir.
The other man?
His name is Siskind, another shipmaster, an interesting man.
And the big brute with him?
A bounty hunter called Vorner, just paid muscle.
What about that runty thing at his feet?
The runty thing goes by the name of Sholto Unworth, sir. Yet another shipmaster, more particularly, the proof.
Trice looked at Revoke.
What do you make of Akunin?
Scared.
Scared of us, and scared that, with Thekla dead, he's now got seniority in the cartel. I can sense he wants out, but only if he gets a massive payoff to keep him quiet. He sees this evidence about Ravenor as his get-out clause.
Does he indeed?
What about this other one, Siskind?
You said he was interesting.
Revoke smiled. Master Siskind reads as ambitious. He's an associate of Thekla's who wanted to become part of the Contract 13 cartel, except that he didn't have the funds to buy in. He's done all the hard work here, sir. He was the one who realized Thekla was missing. He hired Vorner to track Ravenor to Eustace Majoris and brought that proof to Akunin as collateral to buy into the cartel.
Trice straightened out his gold-hemmed robes and put on his game face.
This Siskind sounds like my kind of bastard. What about the bounty grunt?
Does what he does for cash.
Trice turned to Revoke.
Let's go and talk to them, he said. The men rose as Trice and Revoke entered the room. All except Unworth, who was curled up in a bloodied ball in kicking reach of Lucius Vorner.
"Master Akunin," Trice announced, hurrying forward and clasping the man by the hands. "A thousand apologies for ignoring your many calls. I have been so busy these last few days."
"No apologies necessary, Chief Provost," Akunin nodded.
"No, I must. Revoke here treated you most shamefully. Apologize, Revoke."
"I beg the shipmaster's forgiveness." Akunin nodded. "There's no need, Chief Provost. I only wish to serve. I have brought this piece of scum to your attention. Proof that Inquisitor Ravenna moves against us both. His name is Unworth. He brought Ravenna here."
"Is this true? Is Ravenna here on this world?"
Trice asked. Unworth mumbled something and then yelped as Vorner kicked him.
"So, Ravenna. Ravenna," Trice sighed, seating himself. "The cartel slipped up there, didn't it?"
Akunin sat down facing the Chief Provost.
"Thekla may have been overconfident, sir."
"Overconfident? He promised to trap and kill Ravenna for me, and yet Ravenna is alive and Thekla is dead." "Overconfident is hardly the word."
Akunin cleared his throat.
"Which is why I have come here with this evidence, sir."
Trice grinned broadly.
"And for that I thank you. How will the cartel pay?"
"Pay, sir? For what?"
"For messing up. For failing to complete the task I set them."
Akunin cleared his throat for a second time and sat forward.
"I'm not sure what you mean, Chief Provost. Thekla failed you. Him and the agents you sent to help him. They bungled the mission. I'm just here to—"
Trice put his finger to his lips pensively and looked at the ceiling.
"A moment. Thekla, wasn't he the senior member of the cartel?"
"Yes, he—"
"He represented the cartel?"
"Yes, sir, but—"
"And now he's dead. You fulfill that role."
Akunin nodded.
"Yes, Chief Provost."
"So you are now the senior representative of the cartel?"
"I suppose I am."
Trice paused.
"The cartel which entirely failed to serve me?"
"Well, put like that."
Trice nodded to Revoke. Revoke drew his las pistol and shot Akunin through the back of the head. Akunin's corpse slammed face down onto the low table, cracking its glass surface. Revoke snapped his aim up and found himself facing Lucius Vorner's steady bolt pistol.
"No need for any of that," Trice said. "Put it away, Revoke. You too, Vorner. Master Siskind?"
"Sir, I wish to employ fresh blood as leader of my cartel of traders. The old ones were so unreliable. I rather fancy you'd do a better job. What do you say?"
Siskin smiled.
"I'd say put the bolter away, Vorner."
Vorner obeyed.
"Return to your ship and await instruction,"
Trice told Siskin.
"I'll have clerks sent up to you with copies of the contracts.
This is grown-up stuff now, Siskin.
Are you up to it?"
Siskin nodded.
"What about Unworth? Leave him here with me."
Siskind and Vorner departed. Revoke knelt down beside Unworth.
"What do you get?" Trice asked.
"He knows little. Ravenna was careful, but he definitely brought Ravenna here, and he was paid to do it secretly." "If Ravenna's here secretly, it means he knows he's out on a limb and can't trust anyone, not even the local Ordos, which, of course, is very wise of him. He'll be operating on... what's it called?"
"Special condition, sir."
"Just that. A virtual rogue. And therefore infernally dangerous."
Trice took a deep breath.
"No more covert play, Taurus. Unslip the psychers. Unleash every secretist. Find Ravenna. And burn him for me."
Chapter 4 Zale poured the glass of cordial halfway to his mouth and looked upwards. The glass slid out of his fingers and smashed on the floor between his feet. He didn't seem to notice it.
"Zale," I asked. "Didn't you feel that?" he asked. "I mean, you must have. It was so bright."
I was about to reply when it hit me. A flash flood of psi power. distant but immensely powerful, swirling across the hive. I was getting it real time. Zale, foreseeing, had sensed it about to happen. Masked in careful deceits, I reached my mind out. The vast sighscape of Petropolis, to me a blur of dull colors and mind forms, was punctuated by five specks of light that rose up over the stacks and spires, bright as supernovae. Five psychers of great potency had just gone bodiless and were projecting themselves out over the city hive. They were hunting, searching for something. I saw pearls of fire spit out from some, dripping across rooftops, from others, beams like searchlights, tracking back and forth. There was no clue to their identities, but I was sure that none of them was the psyker I had seen with Trice outside the diplomatic palace four nights earlier. I estimated I could handle any two of them, but all five together. They exuded a brute confidence and skill that reminded me of a devil called Kinski. I could not allow them to sense me. At my instruction, Frauke made himself untouchable, obscuring me, Zale, and Miseramus House from view. He was raiding the larder, piling a plate with cuts of meat, cheese, and slices of swota bread from the boxes of provisions we'd brought in. He already had a goose's drumstick clamped in his mouth.
"What's going on?" he mumbled through it.
"Something big," I transponded. "I need you back at your station." He glanced for a moment at the pile of food on his plate. "Leave that," I said. "You can come back for it." Carl put the plate down, but kept chewing at the drumstick as he followed me down the hall. It wasn't like Carl to eat with such gusto. He normally picked at his food and exhibited dainty table manners. He was also forever going on about careful diet and the trimness of his figure. By the time he'd got back in front of his cogitators, he'd stripped the meat off and tossed the bone into the wastebasket. Still munching, he wiped his greasy mouth across the back of one hand and started at the screen.
"Something's going on all right," he agreed,
typing at the keyboard and pulling up different displays of data. "There are at least five psychers active right now," I said. Swallowing the last mouthful, he code-typed his way through further digitized information. Realizing both his hands were oily and slick from the drumstick, he casually wiped them on the front of his soft, cream, Litten silk shirt.
"Lots of ministry activity. Magistratum, too. Some kind of alert," he said.
He reached up and picked a fleck of goose meat from between his teeth with his fingernail.
"Sir, this is far, far more than the creeping backwash scans they've been running since the attack on Trice. This is all-out open season. They're looking for something. Looking hard."
"Any ideas what, Carl?"
He shrugged. "The ministry traffic is coded. Encrypted, actually. I can't break it. Throne, it's the strangest code I've ever seen. Like they're not even using words."
"All right, back down. Have they found our graft in the Informium?"
"Not yet, sir."
"Nor should they, but keep watching in case they do." I swung my chair round to face Zeph Mathewin. "Pack us up, Zeph," I said. "We might need to exit in a hurry." He nodded. "Zale can help you."
"If we do exit in a hurry," Zeph asked, "any idea where we might go?"
"Contact Dr. Belknap. He might be able to help." Zeph paused, as if reluctant to leave the room. "What is it?"
"What about the others? Kiss, Nail, and Kara. With Frauke on, they're cut loose and on their own."
"That's just how it's going to have to be," I said. Now in her fifth hour as a dispatcher, Kara was going numb. Her back ached, thanks to the Spartan stool she was obliged to perch on, and her fingers were slowly going dead from processing the cylinders, sorting them, emptying them, loading them, sending them on their way. Worse than that, her mind was weary. The constant din of the pneumatic tube dispatch hall, the poor lighting, the remorseless pace of work, the rattle, rattle, rattle of the multigraphing pool next door. Documents arrived coded or labeled with numerals she had to struggle to read before she could assign them. She felt almost overwhelmed, moving back and forth between repetitive physical action and lines of meaningless digits. And they really were meaningless. In the first hour or so of the shift, Kara had assumed the sheaves of data she was being given to root were incomprehensible because she was new and didn't understand the complex workings of administry filing and language. But that wasn't true. She was sure of that now. Every file coming in or going out was just nonsense. A gatherer arrived at her station with the latest load.
He didn't speak, didn't even look at her, as he dropped the bundle of brown-sleeved files into her processing basket. She picked up the top one, read the department code off the cover, then sneaked a quick peek inside. Just like before, the files and documents had a sort code for identification purposes, usually a marker that meant they had to be sent from an anagramist department to a cipherist hall, or vice versa. But the actual document was gibberish. No text that could be read, no headings or paragraphs or tables of contents, no graphs or results or minutes of discussion, no punctuation or syntax, just oddly spaced columns of letters or numerals, sometimes one or the other, sometimes a mix of both. It wasn't even as if they were written in a language she didn't know. She was processing raw data in discrete chunks. Just looking at it made her giddy. A clatter beside her made her jump, and she closed the file quickly. A servitor had just dropped a load of empty cylinders into the cage that sat at her feet, like an ammunition hopper full of heavy stub shells. She hooked one out, packed the file inside, and fired it on its way up the appropriate tube. Kara knew she'd be feeling better about things if Ravener had been looking through her eyes, and scrutinizing things too. But he'd suddenly gone quiet almost an hour earlier, and she hadn't heard a thing since. "Boss," Nail whispered into his sleeve, pretending to cough. Still nothing. That was the worst thing about having a little voice in your head. You missed it when it was gone. He was pushing his laden cart down one of the main hallways, just another gatherer in the dense bustle of two-way traffic, following the signs to his next delivery point. No one spoke, but there was a constant noise, footsteps, squeaking wheels, rattling servitors, popping tubes, the occasional buzzer or call chime. It felt like being buried deep in the workings of a giant clock, the springs and screws and gears moving all around. Except, Nail thought, there would be some regulated order to a clock, no matter how complex its design. The systems and motions and processes of this place felt more like the inner guts of some baffling engine, designed by insanity or genius, or both, laboring away towards some final, unguessable, esoteric product. "You're getting jumpy, Harlan," he told himself. His current destination was a processing hall on level 19. When he got there, he had to join the end of a queue of gatherers waiting to enter. He took a rest, leaning on the handle of his cart as the line slowly edged forward.
"Long day, huh?"
he said to the gatherer waiting in front of him. The man stared at him blankly, then looked away. Nail shrugged and turned to regard the flow of workers passing by down the corridor. Other gatherers rolled up to join the queue behind him. He turned to face his cart, and idly reached down and opened the crinkled, rubber-stamped cover of the uppermost document. Inside, another stack of printout pages, covered in columns of characters and numerals that made no sense. Every document he'd managed to sneak a look at that day had been the same. Maybe they do mean nothing, he thought. Maybe there is no more data in the Imperium to be processed, so the Administratum is just circulating random material through its system in order to justify its continued existence. In a place as soulless and unending as this, he could well believe it. A hand reached in and firmly pressed the file cover shut. Nail looked up and found himself eye to eye with a frowning ordnance.
"This is not reading material, gatherer,"
the ordnance said in a reedy voice. Instead of replying, Nail took a cue from the gatherer in front of him and simply stared back blankly.
"Deliver, collect, never tamper,"
the ordnance said, and moved on down the line. Nail's part of the cue finally moved into the processing hall. It was the largest one he'd seen yet, the size of a mass conveyance's main hold. It was impossible to guess how many scribes and processors manned the long rows of chattering data engines and arithmometers. The dry air was filled with the constant timpani of their fingers. There was the usual activity in the aisles, gatherers distributing or collecting, supervising ordnance, dispatch runners, the occasional drifting servo skull. One dipped down and hovered towards him. Lights in its sockets glowed dull green, and small manipulator limbs equipped with quills dangled either side of its vox grill like the mandibles of a beetle. The drone extended a quick, bright bar of hard light and read Nail's slate.
IO-42,
it told him in a buzzing voice that was entirely synthesized. Nail rolled his cart towards the 42nd aisle
and then proceeded down it between lines of typing scribes at their stations until he found the first cogitator that matched his transfer codes. He put the file into the scribe's basket. The scribe didn't look up. Bathed in the screen glow, the man's bloodshot, unblinking eyes reflected back the steadily scrolling digitized display. Nail continued down the line, distributing the folders into pending trays. Overhead, a tannoy announcement blared out, extolling the virtues of a fast, fluid work rate. Nail's cart was almost empty. As soon as he'd finished, a drone or an ordnance would direct him to another aisle for collection. He heard a sharp, sudden cry and looked up. 3 aisles away, 30 meters or so from where he stood, the scribe at one particular cogitator had rocked back from his screen and was beginning to convulse. A fierce seizure gripped the man's body, shaking him so hard several of his spinal data plugs tore out. Instinct told Nail to go and help the man, but he stayed where he was. Not a single scribe in the room had even looked up, and most of the gatherers were simply carrying on with their rounds. A few, like Nail, had paused to look up with vague, canine curiosity. 2 ordnance shuffled down the aisle and reached the stricken scribe just before he gave a final, violent spasm and slumped headfirst against his screen. There was an audible crack. The man's pale forehead had butted the screen with enough force to craze the glass. The ordnance rolled him back. Even from where he was standing, Nail could tell the man was dead. Blood dribbled from the dent on his brow. One of the ordnance turned to the nearest gatherers, Nail included.
You, assistants here?
Nail and 2 other men pushed forward obediently and helped lift the dead scribe out of his seat. Nail could smell sour sweat, blood, and a corrupted odor that suggested the man had developed sores from too many hours in his seat. Such gross physical ailments were common amongst the administry workers. A junior clerk arrived, pushing a metal trolley. Nail expected to move the scribe's body onto it, but the gatherers put the corpse on the floor. The trolley was for the cogitator. The ordnance uncoupled the machine's data trunks and cables, unscrewed the floor brace, and then had the gatherers lift the unit onto the trolley. It was quickly wheeled away.
"Resume your tasks,"
one of the ordnance told the gatherers. 5 minutes later, as Nail was reaching the end of his aisle, he saw a small team of tech adepts arriving to connect up a new cogitator. 20 minutes after that, as he made his way out of the hall with a reloaded cart, Nail saw that the cogitator was now in operation, a replacement scribe at its seat. The body of the dead scribe still lay in the aisle, ignored, awaiting collection. Patient's kiss blinked. She thought for a moment that she had actually been asleep, but her fingers were still striking the keys, and the bright screen display was still scrolling. She swallowed, recovering her wits, horrified to realize that she had zoned out for a moment. The repetitive function, the noise, the screen flicker had combined to swallow her into a sort of trance. She glanced around at the operators around her, saw their glazed eyes and slack expressions, and knew that, for a moment at least, she had been just like them. According to her chron, almost an hour had passed since she'd last looked at it. In that time, Ravenna had gone. She could no longer feel him. Something must have happened to make him... She suddenly realized she felt sick. Her head was throbbing, and the glow of the screen was making her nauseous. She started to type again, but just glancing between her screen and the file she was meant to be transcribing made her gorge rise again. She put both hands to her mouth and closed her eyes.
"Scribe Yevins, why has your process rate dropped below 20 norm?
Kiss looked up. A male ordnance, so old that the augmetic implants in his withered face were starting to rust, gazed down at her.
"I feel unwell," she murmured.
The ordnance bent down at once, not to assist her, but to inspect the information displayed on her screen. As he looked away from her, Kiss desperately detached the plug wire from the analyzer Carl had given her and coiled it away into her jacket pocket before he noticed it.
"Get up,"
the ordnance instructed her. He picked up the file she was working from, noted the page she was on, and tucked it under his arm.
"Follow me."
She walked after him down the aisle, unsteady on legs, tingling with cramp, nausea swilling through her again. Ahead of her, she heard the ordnance speak into a hand vox.
"G/F1, suspected subliminal. Please attend."
The ordnance led her out of the department hall, along the busy corridor and through a heavy side door into what Kiss thought looked like a holding cell. Bare metal walls, tiled floor, a ceiling covered with acoustic baffles. There was a simple wooden table with two chairs on one side and a stool on the other. The ordnance pointed to the stool, and Kiss sat down. It was hot. She took off her coat and folded it across her knees, fighting down the bilious feeling inside her. Two men entered the room. They wore robes similar to the ordnance, but Kiss had no idea what rank or department they represented. She tried to focus.
Junior Scribe Merritt Yevons, G/F1, Station 86. Work rate dropped, and she complained of feeling unwell.
The men sat down across the table from Kiss. One had a data slate, the other a fresh copy pad and a stylus.
This is the file she was working from,
said the ordnance, passing it to the man with the pad and stylus.
I've marked the page.
The man studied the page. His companion activated the data slate. Transcript of her work, he said, and slid it to the man with the file. He went back and forth, checking the file off against the slate copy carefully. No obvious component, he said at last. He looked up at Kiss. Can you remember any particular character, character group or file sequence that you were working on when you began to feel unwell?
No,
she said softly. Then did a word or a word part or any phonetic structure or group of characters come into your mind at that time?
No,
she said again. Think about it, the other man said. Try to recall carefully. Is there a sound you can associate with your discomfort? Asked the first. He slid the pad and stylus across the table towards her. Perhaps you can write it down, or say it aloud.
I don't understand, Kiss said.
The nausea bubbled through her again. She felt as if she was going to pass out. Let us be open with you, said the first man. We are trying to help you. The data you are processing is in a ciphered form. Your processing is one stage of the decryption. It is possible you have stumbled upon some meaning accidentally.
I don't. It happens from time to time, the other man said. At this stage in the process, scribes occasionally and inadvertently recover some small unit of true meaning. A morpheme, a phoneme, nothing more.
On rarer instances, said the first man, innocuous text, such as this, he gestured to the file, may generate a morpheme subliminally in a scribe's mind. This generally causes feelings of sickness. We wish to recover that subliminal. Once we have done so, we can take steps to improve your well-being. Kiss blinked. She didn't understand anything of what they were saying. It was just as much gibberish as the files she'd been staring at all day. The men carried on talking. She thought about the files, the meaningless jumble of characters floating up the cogitator screen, the way they'd made her zone out. She knew that Ravenor wouldn't have abandoned her without a good reason, but she needed him now. With what concentration she could muster, she reached out with her mind, hoping to find the strength to call to him. Are you listening, scribe? One of the men was saying. She touched his mind, felt his determination. He was convinced she had something in her head, something valuable that he would recover, no matter how long it took.
Help us to help you, said the other man. As soon as we have the subliminal, we can quickly ease your discomfort.
She touched his mind now, saw a quick, brittle flash of what he meant by ease your discomfort. The man waiting just outside the room. The secretist in the sober suit, a gun in his pocket, waiting to be called in to put a round through the base of her skull. Desperation seized her, but the nausea swept in more fiercely than before. Off balance, she half rose, half fell off the stool. She tried to get up, the ordnance trying to help her. But she was too dizzy. Then she threw up violently on the floor, under the table, and rolled onto her side, consciousness fading. The last thing she heard, as if from the other end of an echo chamber, was the ordnance saying,
What is this?
The last thing she saw, as if through the wrong end of a telescope, was the ordnance clutching her green jacket and holding up the analyzer Carl had given her. Chapter 5 3.5 hours after Yada Trice authorized their use, the psychers unleashed by the secretists were called off. The five of them, exhausted from the huge strain of their search efforts, fled back to the flesh forms they had left floating in dank lead holding tanks in the basement levels of the governor's palace, and rested there, moaning and whimpering. It was late afternoon in Petropolis, the sky a dirty scumble of grey clouds and vapour. The moment the psychers ebbed away, a fierce thunderstorm broke out over the hive. Revoke knew keeping the psychers active any longer would have been unwise. Quite apart from the fact that the psychers had come close to draining their energy reserves, and he had no wish to burn out such a valuable resource, Revoke was aware of the civil issue. Though invisible and intangible to all but the most gifted or sensitive persons in Petropolis, such overt, proactive psi activity would unsettle the general population. As it was, the data reports were busy with stories of panic attacks, freak weather effects, unprovoked domestic violence, numerous suicides, and reputed sightings of the manifesting dead. Formal complaints had been made by the Astropathic Guild, the Navis Nobilitae, and several other august imperial institutions that utilized psi adepts by legal covenant. Trice had the ministry issue polite responses, suggesting that another grave incident like the one at the diplomatic palace had taken place, but was now under control. Months of careful political manipulation and other more devious machinations meant that virtually all agencies and organizations in Petropolis were directly or indirectly under the control of Yeda Trice, including the Astro Telepathicus and the Officio Inquisitoris Planetia. But most of them didn't realize that fact, so it paid to be circumspect. There was another reason the psychers had been put back in their boxes.
"We've found him," said Bonehart, one of the senior lieutenants of the secretists, as Revoke entered the council room.
"Show me,"
Revoke replied. He had brought Monica with him, and like a heat haze shimmer, she hovered at Revoke's elbow as he examined the printouts Bonehart was unfolding.
"Plenty of hits, as you can see," Bonehart said.
He was a tall man with a craggy face pitted by old acne scars, his hair an oily, hard-combed shelf of grey.
"Hive like this is a target-rich environment. Over 9,000 potentials, but you can rule out all the ones I've put across through. Low-level sensitives, or latents, who don't even know what they've got. That leaves about 200 higher-grade returns, true actives. Most of them will be hucksters, faith healers, backroom clairvoyants, spiritualists, maybe even the odd sub-cult member. Some of them are interesting, and we should pass the locations to the magistratum."
"But none powerful enough?" Revoke asked. Bonehart shook his head.
"You said our guy's major grade, didn't you?"
"From the briefs I've read, dangerously powerful," Revoke replied.
"Well then, no," said Bonehart. "If we're looking for a gamma or a beta, an alpha even, there are only a few hits that match."
He tapped his finger on the graph at a particularly large wobble in the signal.
"Like that, except that's the Astropath Guild, and that's the Guild's substation at 10th Arch. In fact, most of the big returns here can be identified as legit psi uses, except these four." He pointed. "This one, up in Stairtown. Could be our man, but intelligence suggests it's a known unsanctioned psyker called F-Fool Trevis. Same story here in Central F, another black market mine pirate known to us. And here, in J, same again. I've sent teams out to secret all three, but I'm pretty sure all we'll be doing is closing down unsanctioned activities that the Ordo should have picked up long since."
"Which behind leaves one?"
Monica whispered.
Bonehart nodded. "That's right. This one. It fits damn well. High-grade activity, Delta at the very least. The site is meant to be unoccupied, so that matches too. A hideaway. Someone acting in seclusion."
"Show me the map," Revoke said. Another of the secretists passed him a hand slate. "The chief provost was quite particular. We are to move in immediately and end this." Revoke looked up at the secretists around him. The low-lit room was quiet except for the chatter of codifiers and data engines. "Ravenna is an imperial inquisitor. We must not underestimate his abilities, nor the abilities of the men and women who accompany him. This will be a full-force operation, maximum prejudice. I'll be leading it. I want you, Bonehart and Monica. Ptolemy, Rove, and Molle as team leaders. Combat ordnance. Where's Drax?" Secretist Molle looked awkwardly at Bonehart.
"I thought you'd been told, Taurus," Bonehart said. "Drax is dead."
"Since when?" Revoke asked, his voice as heavy and cold as permafrost.
"This morning," Molle replied. "He was part of the operation to secrete the members of Special Crimes. Someone shot him at a residence in Formal E."
Who was he secreting? Mole referred to his data slate. A junior marshal called Maud Plighton. She worked with Rickens, lived with her uncle at the address. Two other bodies were recovered from the scene, one male, one female, so that probably accounts for the girl and her uncle. Both were reported as shredded by the Sheenbirds. Maybe this junior marshal popped Drax before the birds got her. Revoke pursed his lips. What is the status of the unkindness now? The loose, naturally, Bonehart said. But we've got Drax's pupil Folon working to bring them under control. He's a good boy. I estimate we'll have the unkindness back in play before the morning.
Very well, said Revoke. I'll review this matter again later. For now, we have our priority.
And we'll just have to do it without bird cover. Harness up. I want us airborne in 20 minutes.
Thunder pealed across the murky city. In formal E, rain lashed down out of the premature night, rippling the windows of Miseramus' house. Frauke was cooking. Zeph was still prowling the place, a gun in his hand. Karl had gone upstairs to shower. I sat, watching over Karl's machines as they mumbled and whirred, watching data fields pulse and flicker on the screens. Whatever had been stirred up was now dying down, but that didn't mean we could relax. Only the insane or the recklessly powerful would unleash 5 psychers to scour an imperial hive. No, let me correct myself. Only the insane, the recklessly powerful, or the Holy Inquisition would unleash 5 psychers so. We had not been found, and Whiston's limiter was still off, blotting me out from prying minds. But it was just a matter of time. My confidence was faltering. I had come back to this world, dragging my loyal friends along to uncover some great conspiracy. I had even boasted that I thought it might go right to the top. Now, the more I pushed, the higher it got. Arrogantly, I had come back to this world under the badge of special condition, cutting myself off so heroically from support or backup, safe in the knowledge that I was an imperial inquisitor, and, armed with that authority, I could explode this heresy. Hubris. That's meant to be noble, isn't it? As a human quality, it rates next to stupidity, in my opinion. We were going against foes of demonstrably formidable power, the planetary authorities themselves. Just us, the 8 of us, if you included Zale. We would all pay for my arrogance. Every single one of my friends would...
What are you thinking about?
Zale was with me, curled up in a drum chair. Guess. He sat up.
You were thinking that we're really fricked up, he said.
Where did you learn language like that, Zale Eternity? I asked. Have you been hanging out with Nail too much?
He smiled. Streets of Petropolis, born and bred, he said. I know all kinds of swears.
I'm sure you do.
Was I right?
He asked. I hesitated for a moment. We could be in a difficult situation, Zale. I may have put you in a difficult situation. If I have, I'm sorry.
Can't you find the bad guys, then?
I turned my chair to face him. Some of them. What really matters is what they're trying to do. We don't know that yet. Once we do, maybe we'll...
What?
He asked. Die horribly, I thought. Do something about it, I transponded.
Sacristy, he said suddenly, getting to his feet and reaching for a glass of water from Carl's desk.
What? I asked.
Sacristy. I don't know what the word means, but I had a dream where it was very important. Dreams are important, right? You told me that.
For someone like you, I said, and spurred my chair towards him. Say it again. Sacristy. He nodded.
Sacristy. I had this dream, and when I woke up, I thought I'd better remember that. So I did. But only just then.
Tell me about it. He blushed. Go on.
All right. I was dreaming I was in this lovely golden place, like a landscape. Green hills, woods, a glade, all these beautiful people walking around with halos of light around them. There were some buildings, too. I think they were golden. That's probably where the golden thing comes from.
Uh-huh. Move on.
So, one of the people is Kara, and she looks really good.
He paused and blushed a darker shade.
She had this white gown on. It was really tight. Halter neck. And she said she made me promise.
What?
If I remembered to tell you the word sacristy, she'd take her dress off and...
I swung away. That's great, Zale. Keep up the good work.
But I haven't told you the end of the dream yet,
he protested. I can imagine.
But...
Carl wandered in. He'd showered and changed. He was wearing black velvet trousers with high boots and a tight black singlet. It showed the taut flesh of his torso and arms, but it also displayed the grim, puckered suture scars around his right upper arm where the limb had been reattached. I was surprised. Carl had been so fastidious about hiding his awful wound so far. He had been ashamed of it and thought it spoiled his perfect looks. No longer, apparently. He smiled at me.
What are you two talking about?
You don't want to know, I said.
Oh, I do,
he grinned, sitting down at his workstation. Kara undressing, I said, trusting that would put him off.
I had a dream, Zale protested. I'm sure you did, little man,
Carl beamed.
You two boys and your smut when you get alone together.
Now I felt embarrassed. Carl's fingers danced across the keyboard, pulling up the latest data schemes. Carl had always worn jewelry. It was part of his measured elegance, but now I saw that every finger on his right hand was laced with rings, 4 or 5 to each digit. The left hand was bare. Nice rings, I suggested.
Thanks,
he replied, flexing his right hand towards me to show off nearly 30 rings, including those around his thumb.
If you've got them, flaunt them, I say.
Status, I asked him.
Carl looked at his screen. Lots of agitation still. Plenty of ministry comm traffic. Plenty of magistratum flair. Give me a sec to punch up some data for you.
The vox chimed. It was Zeph. Contact coming in. Stand down. It's Nail. Harlan had ridden the commute rail back into E from the ministry towers. He was tired and hacked off and bedraggled from the storm.
Don't think I could handle another day like that, Gideon,
he told me as he settled down next to me, swigging a big Amasek Carl had poured for him.
I mean, I thought our lives were supposed to be hard. In the ministry towers, like a drone, it's a mind killer. Just relentless crap. You know, I actually saw a scribe die at his station. And you know what they rushed to the medics? His cogitator.
Why? I asked. Nail shrugged, sipping his drink. Rain clattered against the windows like pebbles. He looked more exhausted than I'd ever seen him, and that was saying something.
It's all about the data, I think. The data.
He shrugged again.
I don't know what they're processing in there, but it's not straight information. It's like code. A jumble. A cipher. It seems all wrong to me. Then again, I don't know what it's like in any administratum center.
You sampled the sort of stuff you're talking about, I asked. Nail nodded.
Yeah, I used my picta when I could. You make sense of it.
We'll see, said Carl. I still haven't made anything intelligible out of the stuff from Kiss's feed.
Speaking of, where is Patience? Carl asked. Nail frowned. Kara had told me she intended to visit Belknap before she came back, so he could check her dressings, so I wasn't expecting her for another couple of hours at least. But Patience, like Nail, was supposed to come straight back to Miseramus after her shift. She should have arrived by now.
Her analyzer's no longer transmitting, Carl reported. Hasn't been for quite a while now. I just assumed she'd turned it off.
Whiston, I said. Frauke paused.
You sure? It could still be a risk.
Do it, please. He activated his limiter. Immediately my mind rose free. I reached out carefully, masking myself, but the psychers had gone, leaving an aggravated weather pattern behind them. Patience.
I couldn't see her.
Couldn't even sense her unique biosignature. Patience! There was no reply. The armored flyers dipped down towards the target location, mobbing through the evening light and the thunderstorm. Clad in black body armor, his hellgun cinched across his belly, Taurus Revoke climbed to his feet in the red-lit hold of the lead flyer. He looked back at the secretists, harnessed to the bare metal walls.
Make ready to deploy! He called above the purr of the jet wash.
As if thickened and darkened by the storm, night had closed in across the bayside of the hive. Squalling inshore winds crashed the high tide against the breakwaters, pounding the stone piers of the outer flood defences.
The occulting lighthouse, a black tower against a black sky, pulsed out its regular flashes, as if defiantly refusing to match the haphazard rhythms of the lightning. Inside, the cold, gloomy chambers and galleries had been lit by thousands of tapers and old, stained glow-globes. The storm winds hissed in under ill-fitting doors and rotting shutters, gusting like unquiet spirits along the dark halls, guttering the taper flames. Five of the freighters, armed with tinder sticks, were occupied in a patrol of the lighthouse, relighting all the tapers and candles the intruding wind extinguished. Most of the other fratery members were at devotion in the stock brick basement, or working in huddled groups in various parts of the structure to record the latest refinements to the prospect and its focus and determiners, as revealed by the meniscus. The psyker who Orphea Kulzean had ordered them to procure, an evil-tempered renegade astro-telepath called Human Vilner, had arrived that afternoon, and he was hard at work relaying the whispered messages of the freighters on Nova Derma. In his private chamber, bathed in the light of the five oil lamps, the Magus Clancula was taking his supper. Gordle, a junior freighter with a face mercilessly disfigured by disease, was feeding Lezard liquidized nutrition supplements with a long-handled spoon. Lezard's exoshell lacked the subtle motor control to feed himself, and his crumbling, back-peg teeth were long past dealing with solids. After every couple of spoonfuls, Gordle sponged the Magus Clancula's chin with a cloth.
"A little more wine,"
Lezard wheezed, and Gordle obediently held the cup up to his mouth. There was an urgent knock on the chamber door.
"Come,"
Lezard called. Arthus entered, along with Freighter Bonidar. They both appeared anxious. Each of them carried armfuls of paper scraps, seer papers, so many that some slipped from their grasp and fluttered to the floor.
"Magus," Arthus began.
"What's the matter?"
Lezard asked, elevating his exoskeleton so he was standing.
"A sudden, I don't know what to call it," Arthus stammered. "A sudden flurry in activity from the meniscus. We're being inundated with new determiners." "They're coming so fast, they're contradicting themselves," said Bonidar.
Lezard remained composed.
"My brothers, my dear brothers, calm yourselves. When you have served the Silver Mirrors as long as I have, you will know that from time to time such urgency breaks out. A sea change has occurred somewhere, perhaps a quiet, subtle thing. Someone has experienced a change of heart, or inadvertently reckoned upon a new course of action. Some subtle thing. Its effects, however, may be far-reaching for our prospect. So the future is reshuffling its deck, rearranging itself to compensate. A knock-on effect. That is what causes these occasional flurries of contradiction. By the morning, it will have calmed, just as this storm will pass and calm, and a new, true picture will be readable. Why, I remember a time on Glorisant, years ago, when—"
"I think," Arthus butted in, "I think it's more than that. See for yourself."
He held out a clutch of the papers in trembling fingers. Lezard squinted to read them because the thin scraps were backlit by one of the lamps.
"Ravenna, Ravenna, Ravenna," said Arthus. "And again, here, and here, and see? Trice, again and again. 20, 30 times."
The Magus Clancula raised a metal-caged hand.
"They are known determiners, both of them major focal points. This is to be expected."
"But new names are appearing too," Bonidar said.
"Here, this name, Revoke. We've not seen it before now, but it has turned up 8 times. And this one, Boneheart. And this one, Mole. And others besides."
Lezard frowned.
"Show me,"
he said. The two freighters dropped their paper scraps onto the floor, knelt down and began scrabbling through them, holding up certain readings to show the Magus Clancula.
"Here," said Arthus, "another new name, Zael Aethernity. It occurs, by my count, 6 times, and this, Kara Swole, 2 instances."
"3, corrected Bonidar. "Also this name, Siskind, and this one, Lillian Chase, and this, Zygmunt Moritz. His name is clouded, but it features on 13 occasions.
All will become clear once the future settles.
Lazard began, but the tone of his voice betrayed his concern. Arthus rose from the floor and held out a scrap of paper in each hand.
Read these, then, Magus, and understand our fear.
Lazard bent forward to look at the scribbled writing on the two scraps. One read, Orfeo Calzean. The other said simply, Stefoy. There was a long silence in which only the wind and the rain and thunder spoke.
Bring Freighter Stefoy to me,
Lazard said quietly. The two freighters nodded and turned towards the door. The front entrance of the lighthouse detonated. Throughout the building, the brothers of the Divine Frattery barely had time to react before a second blast shook the place, then a third. The tang of smoke filled the lower chambers, and the brothers could hear cries and the blurt of gunfire. They ran to grab weapons of their own. The killers broke into the lighthouse from all sides, kicking in doors, smashing through window shutters. The storm blew in along with them, and to the bewildered freighters it seemed as if the wind and rain had taken human form to invade their stronghold. The first group of freighters to have found firearms clattered down the main staircase into the entrance hall and met the wrath of the invaders head-on. Unarmored and firing only poor-quality las pieces and autoguns, the freighters were cut down without quarter. The intruding killers, grim figures in their black combat plating, stalked forward out of the smoke billowing from the ruptured threshold, placing shot bursts with their hellguns. Freighters were blown off their feet as they tried to return fire, or were hit in the back as they broke and fled. The hallway and stairs were quickly littered with tangled bodies. Up, Revoke signaled to Bonehart. His mind already had a firm lock on the side trace somewhere in the basement area. Bonehart led his squad up the staircase, firing from their shoulders at the landing above as they went. Clipped by the whining energy bolts, sections of the old wooden banister exploded and shattered. The body of a freighter tumbled down, hit the stairs, and slithered to a halt. As Bonehart's secretists reached the landing, a group of freighters led by Bonidar pinned them briefly, establishing a ragged crossfire from the doorways of the first-floor rooms. One of the secretists staggered back, wounded. Bonehart got him behind the stairway wall and threw a grenade. The bang of light and pressure threw debris out across the landing and forced Bonidar and his men back, dazed and shaken. The secretists rushed them. They swung into each doorway, firing their hellguns on rapid. Freighters jerked and fell, blown backwards, some dismembered by the searing shots. Bonehart himself stormed the largest chamber. Firing from the shoulder, he killed the three freighters in the doorway, then swung round to slaughter two more who were trying to hide behind a table. Bonidar was in the far corner. He ran at the looming secretist, firing his las rifle. Two bolts scorched off Bonehart's shoulder guard. With an amused grunt, he altered his aim and fired a single shot. It exploded Bonidar's sternum, communicating such force to the freighter's body that it flew backwards across the room, smacked into the wall, and dropped on its front. A bitter hub of fighting now broke out on the back stairs as Molay's team began to push in through the lighthouse's undercroft. Freighter Arthus and about 20 of the brothers, armed with autoguns and laslocks, were defending the stairhead, and they had the advantage of cover. The stairwell air became a thick fume of rising smoke through which jittering bolts crisscrossed and glittered. Molay dropped back and signaled to the handlers in his team. The men released their cannon hounds. The quadruped weapon servitors pounded forward, heavy and hunched as mastiffs. They came up out of the smoke and began to thump up the stairs, their eyes projecting the pink lances of their recognition beams. The freighters immediately began to concentrate their fire on them, but hard round and las shot alike bounced off the servitors' chrome armor. For a moment, both cannon hounds were lit up with white sparks as ordnance spattered off them. Then they returned fire. Each weapon servitor was armed with a pair of gun pods mounted either side of its hulking shoulders. The combined firepower of the four las rifles shredded the stairhead, and most of the defending freighters along with it. The cannon hounds padded forward through the burning devastation they had wrought, playing their recog beams across the charred bodies, looking for anyone still alive. Any they found was dispatched with a single, close-range las pulse. Freighter Arthus had lost most of a leg in the fusillade. He tried to drag himself clear, grunting in pain and fear as the hounds closed in behind. Arthus glanced over his shoulder just as the first pink beam found him. Then the las pulse cracked and the freighter's head vaporized.
On the floor above, Freighter Gordle and half a dozen other brothers were trying to carry the Magus Clankula to a room where they could best defend him. A few other freighters ran ahead, frantically searching for sanctuary. Behind them, they could all hear the rattle of exchanged weapons fire as armed brethren held a rear guard at the end of the passageway. Monica had taken the semblance of the first freighter she'd seen on entering the lighthouse, and in that guise she now joined Gordle and his fellows, apparently to help them with their efforts to carry the Magus Clankula. As soon as she was in amongst them, she drew her serrated blade. One of the freighters suddenly fell back against the wall, blood jetting from between the fingers he had clamped to his throat. Another to Lezard's left fell with a shriek.
"What in the name of—"
Gordle cried. Two more freighters fell dead, and now Gordle and Lezard could see the bloodied blade in the hands of the brother who had most recently come to help them.
"Casca,"
Lezard breathed, aghast.
"What is this you do?"
Freighter Casca smiled, then trembled, and wasn't Casca any more. There was just a vague blur in the smoky dark, a glimmer of silver like the ocean at night. The blade flashed out and sliced so deeply through Gordle's neck, the serrated edge grated against his spine.
"Please,"
Magus Clankula Lezard whispered. Slowly, Monica lifted Lezard's eye patch and raised the blade towards his one good eye.
"Lead me to this back way."
Freighter Stefoy gasped as the words dug at his brain. He stumbled back a few steps from Eumon Vilna. The Psyker continued to glare at him.
"I'm not sure I know of any—"
"I can see it right there in your head, you turd. There is a tunnel exit out of the basement levels to the west, running inside the flood defenses. Show me. I have no intention of staying here for that to arrive."
Vilna furnished the word "that" with a gesture at the roof, and the sustained sounds of violence echoing down into the basement chambers. Almost all the freighters had left the basement to take up arms, but Stefoy and three others had been ordered to see to the welfare of the odious Psyker. The dank chamber around them was empty, but for the deserted tables laid out with scrying devices, the small silver mirrors, and the bowls of paper scraps.
"Show me,"
Vilna emphasized, hard enough to make Stefoy and the other three wince. Stefoy turned and hurried over into the far corner of the basement area and started to move aside old packing crates. He'd only been told about the tunnel. He didn't know if it was even navigable. But he found himself agreeing with Vilna. It sounded a safer bet than venturing upstairs. Behind the crates, Stefoy found a boarded-up section of wall. He scrabbled at the old planks so hard he drew blood from his fingertips.
"Hurry up!"
The command came with a pain goad this time, and Stefoy cried out. He kicked at the old planks until they began to come away, and then pulled a few off until there was enough room to slide through into the wet darkness beyond.
"Come on, sir,"
he shouted back. Stefoy could hear the booming of the sea, and the darkness smelled of salt. Vilna and the other freighters started forward. The Psyker shoved the brothers aside with his mind, so he would be first to reach the gap in the planking. Suddenly he turned.
"Holy throne,"
he hissed. Revoke was striding across the basement chamber towards them. His hellgun came up, and he started to fire. One of the freighters pitched over, his face blown off. Vilna grabbed the other two brothers with his potent telekinesis and dragged them together so they formed a shield of flesh and bone between himself and the oncoming secretist. Revoke fired again, and the Psy-bound freighters convulsed as the energy rounds ripped into them. Vilna held their exploded carcasses in the air for a second with his mind, then threw them aside, spearing his telekinesis forward to wrench the weapon out of Revoke's grip. It bounced off the ceiling and clattered into a corner. Revoke and Vilna faced each other, rigid as statues, their minds engaged. The basement around them shook with the psychic backwash. Glow globes burst. Tables vibrated and shook precious scrying mirrors onto the floor. Bowls overturned and scattered seer papers into the air. Shaking with effort, Revoke took one slow step forward. Veins bulged like hawsers in Vilna's neck. His hands slowly came up at his sides, fists balled. Revoke took another step forward. Some of the paper scraps spontaneously ignited, swirling in the air like fireflies. Table legs warped and buckled. A small stool tipped over and began to spin like a child's top. Hundreds of the old stock bricks in the wall cracked and shattered, spilling out mortar and dust.